Happy Friday and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. So after being gone for a good, you know, tanned, ready, and rested, Tim Miller is back. But I opened up my browser this morning and I heard this.
So I'm gone for 2 weeks and we're suddenly in danger of losing our Hot Joe summer?
Whoa. Okay. So first of all, welcome back, Tim.
Hey, Charlie. It's good to be back.
Are you
ready? I'm feisty.
Are you worried, though, about losing the Hot Joe summer? I want to know. I want to get your sense of, like, what is your anxiety level about Hot Joe summer? Scale of 1 to 10.
Anxiety level is about a 4, I would say. Speaking selfishly, I'm pretty happy that I got my Hot Joe summer out of the way already before August, as things seem to be getting worse. So, you know, I mean, if it's true that the self is the only thing that you can be certain exists, I feel pretty good about that. As for the rest of y'all, I'm really concerned about the South. We talked about this a little bit last night on the live stream for Bulwark Plus members. Plug for Bulwark Plus members, Thursday night live streams. And my friend is an infectious disease doctor in Louisiana, and has been, you know, kind of on the inner circle of COVID of prep down there and deals with a lot of patients with COVID. And we talked earlier this week, and man, it's pretty depressing. You know, just as far as how hard it is to break through to people, even people who their loved ones are at higher risk of COVID because they're immunocompromised, or the vaccines might not work as well on their loved ones. These are kind of patients he's dealing with, and they're trying to create vaccine bubbles around the patient, and so you got to talk to the husband or the wife and the family members, and people just don't want to do it. You know, people are just so resistant to getting vaccinated because they already have these pent up narratives in their head, and they've quote unquote done their own research. And if you just look at the hot zones, I mean, obviously there are a couple other groups here. Younger folks are straggling, communities, marginalized communities of color, particularly urban communities. Some of them are struggling, but like it's mostly these deep red communities of people who are refusing to get vaccinated. And I mean, the numbers speak for themselves. So I think that there's a lot of fatigue about, lockdown fatigue. And I think that because of the vaccination rates in blue states, it's going to be hard to completely ruin Hot Joe summer and like cancel out, go back to outdoor masking and all this kind of stuff. But boy, I don't know. A damper has been put on the Hot Joe summer. There's no doubt about that.
See, I just want to make it clear that I'm somewhat anti-mask, but pro-vaccine. I am pro-vaccine, therefore anti-mask, which is not to say that I would not wear the mask. It's just that this is all the vaccines, and you're not my party is back. We had the soundbite from it, and you do put the point the finger at the what you describe as the few chuckling chodes and sociopathic sleazes who are spreading lies about the vaccine, and that is a problem. And it's worth noting that we don't have the phrase chuckling chode enough out there. We don't use the word chode enough.
I saw chode in another context. It was either watching a TV show or reading a book or something. I was reading a lot of, beach reads. I wasn't doing deep research on the virus for everybody while I was on vacation. So, one of my books, somebody called someone a chode. And as soon as I saw the word, I was just Tucker Carlson appears in my mind's eye. And I was we have to do it.
So the real value of words like chode and schmuck, the Yiddish word schmuck, is you can call somebody a schmuck and a chode without actually calling them a dick. But that's what it means, right? I mean, they're just simply ways of basically saying you are a human penis, but without having to say human penis. You see,
it's kind of worse than that even. It's like an ugly penis. It's a double.
Exactly.
It's like a 1-2 punch.
So if we say Tucker Carlson is an ugly penis, we'll get an explicit rating on Apple, right? iTunes. For this, but if we call him a chuckling chode, maybe we can go under the radar screen, right?
Ha!
So that just I'm just kind of that's a deep dive. Hey, by the way, before we get into a lot of this stuff, I have a correction from yesterday's podcast. In Fuego podcast with Tom Nichols, we were talking about Congresswoman Cori Bush, who had like one of the worst sound bites talking about, she might spend $200,000 on her own personal security. She had one private security, but really in the same breath also says, but we need to defund the police for all you people who do not have private security. In any case, I identified her as a congresswoman from Colorado. In fact, she is a congresswoman from Missouri. So there is a technical term for that. Do you know what the Greek is for this?
I do not.
Brain fart. okay, we're off to this.
You
start,
had Tim Miller in your head, maybe. She's from St. Louis, right? District, which is Ferguson, where I was born. Yeah. And then I was literally born in Ferguson at the hospital there, or Florissant, right next to it. And then I moved to Colorado. So maybe you just kind of had some sort of you knew I was coming on today, and had like a little bit of a Tim Miller flipperoo in your head.
Nah, there was none of that going on here. So I'm weighing whether or not I should, back into the things before I get to going. I mean, we mentioned the chuckling chode, Tucker Carlson. Ann Applebaum has a great piece about Tucker Carlson's self-loathing international tourism. And I know that some of you think, why you pay that much attention to Tucker Carlson? And we discussed this with Tom Nichols yesterday. What Tucker Carlson is doing is he is explicitly, without any subtlety, normalizing fascist adjacent authoritarianism. And I always want to read you what Ann Applebaum says. She says, Tucker Carlson is spending a week in Budapest in order to annoy Americans and everybody else who believes in the ideals of America. The rule of law, a free press, free elections, the conviction that democracy is preferable to autocracy. Showing how much he despises the United States, its constitution, and its heritage, the Fox News host is celebrating the achievements of a petty Central European autocrat, Viktor Orban. He seems to believe that by paying homage to Hungary's assault on democratic institutions, he will make people angry at home just as his host does. The good thing about Orban, Carlson told a dinner party in Budapest, is that you're truly hated by all the right people. And yes, all the right people includes everyone who still has some faith in the American dream. Wow. I guess I am sick of this, the sense that the right wing somehow has a monopoly on loving America, on patriotism, on flag waving, when really they have a rage against America, and it's so dramatically on display. I guess I often worry about overstatement. In this case, I actually worry that we're understating the awfulness of this particular, chuckling chode in Budapest.
Yeah, well, look, you hit on two things. I want to get into both of them, but on the patriotism part first, because it is really astonishing. I think like during the Olympics, it feels very stark. It's like you have our friend over at National Review, Rich Lowry, writes this whole book about in defense of nationalism. And I feel like every time I open up Twitter, he's like grading our athletes based on how appropriate their, flag waving is after they win medals, right? And like trashing the ones and praising them and, put it in it. And, obviously Trump attacks the women's soccer team and Tucker's in Budapest and, obviously now they hate football and they hate baseball and they hate Coca-Cola and they hate our big, there is a hatred of the growing diversified America that is widespread. And it feels like the more you talk about how much of a patriot and a nationalist you are, the more actually aggrieved you are about the dynamic, wonderful country that we live in.
These are actual Americans. And when the women's soccer team was defeated the other day, the glee, the joy on right-wing Twitter was truly amazing. Especially because they would describe themselves, we are way more pro-American than you are, except when we're talking about these Americans.
Yeah, it's crazy. Imagine going back, and it's just not that long ago. The John Kerry, the Freedom Fries. Remember all this? Like, what if John Kerry in 2004 had been like, "I'm rooting for the French soccer team because one of the American players, is an evangelical Christian or something." If you do the inverse, I mean, just the widespread mockery. But somehow they get away with this. Like they have this protective bubble around themselves because, they. claim, you know, to be such patriots, you know, despite the fact that Kerry was actually a Vietnam veteran and all this. It's kind of hard to really wrap one's head around, like when you really, you know, watch it day in, day out for the last 2 weeks, just how deep-seated their grievances towards their own country. And I mean, I think that this Hungary thing is right, you know, a prime example of it. One of the things that Tucker is bragging on Orban over is you know, how he has control over his borders and he has control over his culture, right? And I think that is what this is all about, right? Like, Tucker does not love the America that is pluralistic and that, as Applebaum said, you know, is, you know, the hope of the world and where we can, you know, achieve your American dream. Like, he loves the blood and soil, you know, I want to go back to 1952 America, and we need to block everyone else out that might even change it one iota. And so Orban is a model for that. But Hungary is very different from the basis of Hungary as a nation is very different from America, right? The history of these countries are very different, right? So it is an analogous, and so it actually shows a loathing of the country. But I do want to talk about Fidesz. Am I saying that right? Fidesz? Hungarian party that Orban's in. Because I know just a little bit about this, because in the late aughts, like early 2010s, Orban was having a lot of Republican political consultants come over. Mm-hmm, and he was really coming to power then as a sort of center-right.
Right.
At least that's how he's positioning himself, you know, politician, right? And he was pushing back against kind of the far left in Hungary. And, you know, there's this coalition of center-right politicians that included like Merkel and Cameron, right? Like extremely, you know, now you consider very centrist, you know, politicians in Europe and working with kind of ex-Bush officials. And I just think that that is an important thing to recognize as far as this slippery slope is concerned. Like Orban very much came in under the mantle of a traditional conservative, and slowly but surely over time, you know, like the frog boiling in water, right? And you know, took over, you know, different elements of, you know, nationalized the communications companies there and took over power of the media companies. And, you know, then obviously this is tied to traditional conservatism, but the, you know, kind of ramped up the anti-trans, anti-homophobia stuff, and then went hardline on the border and kind of slowly but surely morphed into this, the kind of a Trumpian authoritarian figure we see now. And it's the inverse where the Europeans are imitating our politics, but it's like the inverse right now. I mean, I think what you're seeing in Orban is about as good of a model as is out there for like the trajectory of the Republican Party.
No, exactly. And you can't ignore the fact that you have one of the most influential conservatives in the country who is now praising that model and saying that, you know, this is something clearly, I mean, still the implication is there that somehow that, you know, America should become more like Hungary, which is, by the way, we've had a kind of a big week with this, with the American greatness folks talking about the Salazar option, that American greatness involves being more like what Portugal used to be, really. I mean, it's kind of absurd. But this is also part of the flip back to the focus on the border and on the danger of immigrants. Have you noticed that this is the new line? You were gone for 2 weeks. The right sort of has been, you know, flailing around. Do we take vaccines seriously? Do we not take vaccines seriously? Do we spread disinformation? You know, is it no tread on me? They seem to have settled on it's these brown-skinned illegal immigrants who are infected who are the real danger to public health. Have you noticed this? They are all in now on everything is the fault of the border crisis. It's kind of a return to the playbook that they're very comfortable with. I think of it as kind of a replay of the caravans are coming that we heard back in 2018. But, you know, across right-wing media and Republican politicians, it's border, border, border. I mean, it is it's kind of remarkable how fast, even though all you have to do is look at a map of where the hotspots are. And Ron DeSantis is like, you know, he's all in, you know, apex predator mode. You know, Joe Biden, do your job, fix the border. There's no fucking border between Florida and Mexico. These other states, But again, it's a great way of changing the subject, deflecting from their own recklessness to try to come up with who's going to be the scapegoat. And right now, whether you're talking about Fox News or the Washington Examiner or National Review or Wall Street Journal, it's all those immigrants bringing disease with them across the border. And I'm just laying out the marker. This is going to be it. This is their comfort zone, and this is where they're going.
Well, I just want to start by saying, if they're just so upset with the immigrants coming here, everybody is welcome to go to Hungary if Viktor Orban is going to have them. You know, I mean, I've been to Budapest. It's nice about 4 months a year, and about 8 months a year, it's horrible. It's dark and dreary. And, you know, if everybody wants to move to the Hungarian countryside and see if their quality of life increases, I think I support that 100%. So I hope that Rod and Tucker bring everybody that no longer, you know, that is so scared of the immigrants coming across the border that they can't handle it anymore and they need to go into a lockdown ethno-nationalist state. I think Hungary's a great place for them. As far as this border is concerned, here's the thing. It's one of these examples where there's a nugget of a fair criticism here, right? Which is that, like, it is pretty absurd, frankly, that, like, people... that if your, you know, great aunt lived in, you know, Sweden and wanted to come visit you right now, like, she couldn't. Whereas the asylee system is much more holy than that, I guess, as far as giving people options to come. But then the problem is when you take this, like, fair criticism, when I think the result is, by the way, which is people should be able to get vaccinated and fly into America from other countries, and turn it into, oh, now we're blaming the immigrants for this self-inflicted problem that is infesting right. The whole country, right? I mean, the JVL wrote about this week, where if you asked unvaccinated people whose fault it is, the immigrants are the number one answer. The number one.
Right, I know. This works. Well, it's convenient. It really is. It actually shouldn't be that surprising, considering that, I mean, the whole Trump era began with him coming down the golden escalator and, you know, talking about Mexican rapists, right? I mean, this is and the party went, yes, absolutely. And he said, and we should ban all Muslims. And yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is great. This is who we are. So. Well,
and DeSantis has this playbook down, by the way. You can just see all of the, you know, the people that didn't really like Trump's behavior, but just were apologists for him his entire 4 years on the right. No criticism of Ron DeSantis can be broached, right? I mean, you can just see him firing up the defenses on Twitter, all the conservative intellectual class, all the people that were for Scott Walker in 2016. Oh. They are very defensive of their man Ron, and it's like, you know, he hasn't been the worst of the worst, right? He hasn't been Candace Owens. He's not a total anti-vaxxer, but he did get vaccinated on Fox, which I guess is good. But he has this press conference where he's blaming the immigrants for the spike in his state. You know, there are over, I think it was yesterday, it was 160, I can get fact checked on that, but over 100 totally unnecessary deaths in Florida. In Israel and in Britain, they are not having this rate of death, like, post-vaccine. Like, yes, there are some exceptions. Yes, there's some things that slip through the cracks. But, like, Florida is having a massive hospitalization and death crisis that's totally unnecessary. We have a cure for this. And Ron DeSantis is holding a press conference blaming the border and then suing the cruise lines for just the fucking obvious responsible thing, which is, like, requiring the people get vaccinated if you're about to get on a damn ship where you're all stuck together in tight quarters for a week. Yeah, it's madness.
Well, here's the lead in the Washington Post right now. As COVID-19 hospitalizations in Florida surged past 12,000 this week, that's hospitalizations, far exceeding a record already shattered over the weekend, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was fed up, not with those spreading misinformation about vaccines or refusing to take protective measures. DeSantis instead railed against reporters for creating hysteria about rising hospitalizations and accused President Biden of facilitating the virus by not reducing immigration through the southern border. So, I mean, right now, he's the governor of the state that's the epicenter of a summer coronavirus spike fueled by the Delta variant. But again, it's not his fault. It's the media. It's Biden. And you're absolutely right. A lot of the anti-anti-Trump folks have morphed really seamlessly into anti-anti-DeSantis. You criticize DeSantis, and you're going to hear from the usual suspects. Hey, could we just take a break? I want to talk about a couple of things, including the creepy as hell announcement from Apple that they're going to be looking at our phones. I also want to talk about what we've learned in the last several days about the Trump coup, that it was really much more real than we thought. And I want to talk about that on the other side. Hey, Charlie Sykes here. Just a quick reminder, if you sign up for Bulwark Plus, you will have access to our morning newsletters, to JVL's Triad, as well as our whole suite of podcasts. This one will remain free, but if you want to listen to the Secret Podcast or participate in our live streams or others like the Next Level Podcast, please consider joining Bulwark Plus. We're back with my colleague, Tim Miller. Tim, can we just shift gears for a moment? Because this is really...
Before we sort of shift gears, I did one fact check during the commercial break here just because I wanted to make sure I have myself right. Israel, you know, there's about three times less than Florida as far as population. They had six deaths yesterday in Israel, right? Totally. So, I mean, it's just like, it's not... this is just an important, like, image for people, like, for what things should be looking like right now in our Hot Joe summer, right? And, like, what if DeSantis was being responsible, what things should be looking like in Florida, if they were at this rate of a highly vaccinated place like Israel, they'd have, like, 18 deaths yesterday.
Yeah, you know, the entire state.
It's 10 times, right, in the entire state. So it's 10 times that. Like, this is real human life. So anyway, sorry to cut you off.
It is an important comparison because right now, guys like DeSantis think that demagoguing the border is a politically winning issue. And it may be. Let's just let that aside. But you know, the cost of their wager is going to be measured in human lives. These are real people. Did you happen to see that video of the kid who was, who was in the intensive care unit, he was intubated. It's traumatic stuff, and it's the failure. I mean, I suppose that after all these years of cultivated lack of empathy, we shouldn't be shocked that more than 600,000 deaths and a resurge of the pandemic would not affect these guys at all. I mean, okay, so yes, he got vaccinated. Good on him on all of that. But he is fully in chuckling chode mode in every other respect. Don't you think?
Yeah, I haven't watched. I mean, these videos are horrific. I watched a number of them because I wanted to pick one for the Not My Party on vaccinations this week, and they're traumatizing. You can feel the pain of these folks, and it's hard not to get upset knowing that what you think about your fellow man. I mean, there are millions of people out there that can watch these videos and see them and be like, I'm taking my chances on this one. We've got the miracle drug, but you know, I'm just gonna take my hydroxychloroquine instead because I'm gonna be
outraged about the caravan because that's all it is. Hey, by the way, the MyPillow guy, this CNN interview with him. Have you seen this? Have you watched the video?
I didn't get to watch this.
It is truly amazing. I know the people might have read about it. How the guy sits down, the investigative reporter, and he just dismantles Mike Lindell. I mean, again, maybe that's low hanging fruit. But it is a masterful job. It is the evisceration of MyPillow guy is truly a thing of beauty. It is remarkable. Okay, so we're going to come back to this edition caucus and everything in a moment. I have to say this, the one story that is really grinding my gears this morning, and I really do think it's creepy as fuck. This story, again, let me go to the Washington Post so people don't think I'm exaggerating. Apple unveiled a sweeping new set of software tools Thursday that will scan iPhones and other devices for child pornography and text messages with explicit content and report users suspected of storing illegal pictures on their phones to authorities. Okay, you know, child pornography is terrible. Anything we can do to fight it, I am completely in favor of that. However, the aggressive plan to thwart child predators and pedophiles and prohibit them from utilizing Apple's services for illegal activity pitted the tech giant against civil liberties activists and appeared to contradict some of its own long-held assertions about privacy and the way the company interacts with law enforcement. And here's the nut graph here. The move also raises new questions about the nature of smartphones and who really owns the computers in their pockets. The new software will perform scans on its users' devices without their knowledge or their explicit consent and potentially put innocent users in legal jeopardy. So right now, and this is Apple. Remember when they wouldn't unlock their phone after some terrorist, you know, killed all kinds of people because no, privacy was so important. We can't even cooperate. They are now going through your phone. You think it's your phone? You own that phone? They're looking at your pictures. They're looking at these text messages. And again, they say it's looking for child predators. That's great. But does it take that much imagination, Tim, to think about how this might be abused by somebody else who's decided, hey, let's add something else to the list of things we really don't like as the pretext for going through everybody's stuff, because everything you do is on that freaking phone.
Yeah, and I guess that they're supposed to be supposedly comparing it to, you know, things in a government child pornography database. You know, because I saw some pushback on this about people are like, I mean, I don't know. I take what, like, is my 2-year-old in the bath? Or, you know, are you going to flag that photo? And so I think that a lot of questions to be answered at this. My thing about Apple is that it is interesting. I think it's because they do have this kind of goody two shoes liberal, you know, brand identity. And I think more, you know, tend to be, at least in the old days, I think these days everybody kind of uses Apple, but like, you know, initially kind of more liberal user base. Like they get inoculated from these criticisms in a way that like Amazon and Elon Musk and Facebook, et cetera, don't. And it's like, Apple's like basically evil. This has been a long time pet peeve of mine and whatever. I don't know what to do about it though. I use an iPhone and I have an iMac, but like, the combination between this surveillance power and their absolute refusal to, you know, even at all modify their behavior in China. And you know, the fact that a lot of their equipment is built in China and built in regions of China where there are atrocities happening, and their willingness to go along with Xi on, you know, the kind of crackdowns on apps and whatnot that are needed in the country. And you know, then when Trump was in power, Cook was buddying up to him and like basically let him have free PR about how, you know, remember when he talked about how Apple is going to be building all these plants in America as part of Trump's Made in America plan, which was all bullshit. So, it is alarming. I do feel a little bit like helpless on this. And so I kind of try to block it out of my mind, though.
Well,
what are we going to do about it?
Well,
I'm not going to do the Benedict option like Rod Dreher and move to Hungary and get rid of all my devices.
And Rod Dreher, by the way, the Benedict option apparently includes the Orban option, because he's all like fanboy about Tucker Carlson sucking up to Viktor Orban. So, okay, so let's switch back to the Sedition Caucus for a moment. The publication Just Security has just published a timeline of all the things that Mark Meadows, the deplorable former presidential chief of staff, was engaged in on January 6th. And I know that you've been looking really closely at it. I guess this is just another data point that, you know, I think underlines the fact that the efforts to overturn this election were much more serious than even some of the darker, some of our darker fears were. I mean, you know, Bill Kristol, you know, kept tweeting out, I'm still alarmed. And people went, oh, come on, Bill.
Come on, Bill.
And now we're finding out that maybe it was even worse than that. So tell me about I have not had a chance to look at this Just Security timeline on Mark Meadows.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because Meadows plays the two-track thing, right? Like he talks to the mainstream reporters, and when he'll talk to, you know, your friends are on the pod, Rucker and Lenig, yeah, and these folks, you know, and he plays the, well, I thought Rudy was being a little crazy. You know, he plays that game, right? When he's talking to, you know, people in polite company, while, you know, when he's talking to MAGA World, he got caught obviously last week, you know, pretending like Trump is still having cabinet, like cosplay cabinet meetings. I wonder if they were like kind of the Confederate tri-corner hats to these meetings. Yeah, so I think that what Just Security did, which was kind of puncture this, you know, effort by Meadows to do that, and I think really make a very compelling case that he should be compelled to testify under oath. I think they raised the question, which is, you know, a legal question that's above my pay grade, about whether, you know, possibly even the Select Committee should let a grand jury or the Department of Justice move first on this because of the, you know, extent of his exposure. But when you lay it all out, I mean, Meadows was very closely working with Giuliani. I had not realized, I guess this had been reported, but Meadows flew to Georgia and made a surprise visit to the investigator. This is after the election. This is in December. And then arranged the call between Trump and that investigator in Georgia, and then arranged the call between Trump and Raffensperger, the famous call that was leaked. He on January 6th, he was with that just absolute schmuck, Kash Patel, who had actually no qualifications besides being a Trump stooge, but kept getting promoted inside the Trump White House to the point where he was the acting defense secretary's acting chief of staff on January 6th, and was kind of plotting closely with them. I think that there were a number of other people that this timeline demonstrated expressed concerns about Meadows' actions, including General Milley and others. Everyone should just read it all. But there was that one email that was leaked about Meadows being concerned about New Mexico, right? And then he sends it to this Jeffrey Clark fella but Clark is like this random mid-level hack at the Department of Justice that Meadows is trying to then elevate as a potential replacement for Rosen. So you see some of these things, get leaked within big stories or in these books that are coming out. But when you put it all together, it's a very damning picture of his actions and how, many different routes that they were taking as they were considering their options and keeping Trump in power against the will of the people. And it's just very, when you see it all laid out together in one timeline, and it's something that we all knew, but it's good to have all the facts there that just demonstrates this was a legitimate effort for a sitting president who lost re-election to stay in power again, extra legally. And it's unprecedented in American history, and Meadows was a key cog in that, and he needs to be held accountable for it.
A lot of people need to be held accountable, and again, the fact that we're still learning this, or the picture is still coming into focus, underlines again how important I think the January 6th committee is, and how aggressive I hope they are when it comes to when it comes to subpoenas, because I don't think we have the full story. I don't think even with all of the journalism, even with everything that we've seen so far, I still think there's a lot of unknown unknowns or known unknowns.
I will say, right? I've been pretty encouraged. I've had some conversations with, friend of the pod, Adam Kinzinger is now on the committee and some other folks. It does feel like they are, very serious about getting involvement of Republicans and with even former Trump official whistleblowers in this process. And so I do think that, there was maybe a fair criticism of the impeachment efforts, more the first one than the second, but even a little bit the second, that there was a real, that they did a good job of making their case of the performative part of it, but maybe were not as full and thorough as they could have been as far as, trying to, pull every string of potential, Republican folks who had had enough and were ready to play ball. And it definitely feels like they're doing that this time. So that's encouraging. The legal part of this is a big question. I think Kinzinger and them are super hopeful that their subpoenas, that this sort of executive privilege excuse that they used to get out of testifying in the second impeachment is not going to work this time. They're optimistic about that, but, we'll see when the rubber meets the road.
So I have a gift for somebody in our audience who might want to write a book. I was thinking about this last night. You could do a fascinating book on just the 48 hours of January 5th and January 6th and everything that happened and how it changed American politics. January 5th, of course, being the date of the Georgia special election, where Democrats lost control of the Senate, which has had tremendous implications. And of course, everything that happened on January 6th. But speaking of Georgia, that whole Georgia story of the candidates running, and you were all over this, that they were completely in favor of the Sedition Caucus. They were all in on all of that. And this was the day before. And I think a lot of what happened on January 6th was shadowed by the defeat of Republicans the day before in Georgia. I don't think enough attention's been paid to that. By the way, you have also written about the so-called Herschel Walker problem, because one of the bigger elections, and there are many next year, will be the Senate election in Georgia, where Ralph Warnock is up for re-election. And I don't know whether you've seen these polls, but by far the best known of the Republican candidates is the, shall we say, extremely problematic Herschel Walker. And so I see the political playbook is talking about the GOP's Herschel Walker problem, because that guy may actually get the nomination. And that's kind of a PTSD flashback for Republicans who nominated people who then proceeded to completely self-immolate and lose potentially winnable Senate seats.
I want to get to Herschel just one second, but I think you made a really good point about the fifth. And I think that there's this counterfactual where the Georgia runoff wasn't happening, where I think Trump would have been much more limited in his ability to stir up, you know, the, you know, potential overturning of the election, but also just stir up the masses' outrage had he not had those two runoff elections.
Right.
I think it was very much a flashpoint. And I think that
Mitch McConnell might have.
Mitch McConnell, right? Yeah. Say what you want about Mitch. He's made a lot of horrific decisions, but he seemed extremely reluctant to go along with the nonsense after the election, but kind of did because, you know, his majority leadership was at stake. So this is obviously not a profile in courage, and he should, you know, live in shame, you know, for the fact that he went along with it to the extent that he did all the way to the fifth. But, you know, there's, I think, good reason to believe that had the Senate majority been decided already, that McConnell might have, you know, done what he could to crimp, you know, Trump's efforts. I think it wouldn't have totally stopped it, but I think it would have limited it quite a bit.
That's why I think those 2 days are so interesting, because all of the narratives sort of come together. You know, all of the roads lead to that. I mean, it would be because you're absolutely right. Why did the big lie get so much traction? Well, because Republicans just did not want to break with Trump before that election. I mean, it really did. You know, it was kind of the huge roadblock before January 6th. Okay, so Herschel Walker. I mean, Herschel Walker is, I mean, this guy's Looney Tunes. And that's a nice way of saying it.
No, he's completely Looney Tunes, and look, I'm not a doctor. I'm not going to play one on this podcast, but obviously there's always the questions of, like, is there a CTE issue, you know, with the concussions and given what has happened with football. Herschel has actually been very outspoken about how he doesn't have CTE, and, you know, kind of, you have to say it, that raises some questions, but how he does, and how football players need to take responsibility for themselves. And he's very much a, you know, pull yourself up for your bootstraps and be a man kind of guy. He has, on the personal side, is extremely volatile. The stories of how he'd play Russian roulette with people that came to his house, which is you put one bullet in the chamber of a gun, and then you spin it, and then you give the gun to the guest at his home and ask them to shoot him, like to pull the trigger to take your chances. And then the person never did it, obviously. But then Herschel would take the gun from them and say, you're a wimp. I'm going to do it myself and pull the trigger. I mean, this is traumatizing. He had some spousal abuse issues. Obviously went full in for Trump, but I would say even kind of on the MyPillow edge of the election fraud conspiracy theorizing. I mean, you know, as we said, Perdue and Loeffler, you know, went along with this to their shame, but you know, they weren't out there pushing the, oh, you know, bamboo and the ballots and Dominion and dead Hugo Chavez and all this. And Herschel was all in. And on January 4th, Herschel tweeted, like, in all caps, you know, though, we're being stolen. I forget exactly what was the phrasing, but I remember the phrasing of all caps being like, great patriots need to stand up. This is 2 days before the election, and or before the insurrection, rather. His son is a very interesting character, if you're interested in such things. He's a conservative TikTok star. He's a gay, black, young Zoomer TikToker who kind of does like a reverse racism shtick mostly on TikTok. And he on January 6th tweeted that there will be more of this coming, that like the elite, that this is the comeuppance of the elites. Walker, his dad, continued to retweet and share his absolutely insane rants. So, I mean, you can read, if you go back and read the whole Herschel Walker article I wrote, there are a ton of other anecdotes about this. But, you know, suffice it to say, he's a loony. Now, he is polling, as you said, better than, I mean, Loeffler is like, you know, is like the worst of both worlds, right? She has no appeal to, you know, the soft, you know, Raffensperger type Republicans. And she also has, you know, no appeal to the Trumpy type Republicans. So, you know, I guess it's not that surprising that she's polling worse than him. But, you know, potentially Walker can, you know, pull off a little bit, you know, a small percentage more of the black vote, potentially more of a low info voters who kind of just know him as a football star. And obviously he'll have all this baggage would show up in ads. And the reports are that McConnell is trying to push Walker out of the race in favor of someone else, though, you know, I mean, our record as the GOP establishment on this isn't actually that great. Obviously, you know, a lot of times I think you worry about the worst case scenario, which is Walker gets in and then he wins, which is, you know, in an off year, in a good Republican year, very, very possible. So there's an interesting drama both behind the scenes there with the machinations with the Republican Senate and then just the drama of a potential crazy ass Herschel Walker, Christian Walker campaign.
Wonderful. Well, it would not be boring. Okay, so can I talk to you about hate mail?
Oh, please. Do
you get any hate mail? I mean,
I get a little, not too much. I get mostly love mail. I like the love mail. Every once in a while, I get a little hate mail.
Okay, all right. So I put this in my newsletter. You can actually, you know, read this today. It's actually not hate mail. It's a DM. It's and the reason I posted it was because there's kind of the interesting phenomenon, because you probably remember back in the day, those happy days when we were all looking forward to just going back to having arguments about things like budgets, taxes, and eviction moratoriums, right? You know, can't we just disagree on these substantive issues? So this week, I think there was a little bit of disagreement on our part about Joe Biden saying that, yeah, it's probably illegal, but we're going to continue this eviction moratorium, right? I mean, it was kind of a disagreement.
It's fucking ridiculous. But
it is fucking ridiculous. and we said this. Look, I mean, we've spent the last 5 years talking about norms and the rule of law and the Constitution. And they still matter, even though they changed the administration. And I don't know what kind of reaction I noticed. You know, the comments on the live stream last night that most of the progressives seem to understand, or at least respect our dissent from this. You know, essentially saying we're going to ignore the law and we're going to do this anyway. But okay, I got this DM from a guy, and I wanted to share. Okay, so it starts off this way: you supported the Iraq War. But you draw the line at saving 3 million people from being evicted. Okay, so that's some really heroic connecting the dots there. Okay, you draw the line at saving 3 million people. I know you've been anti-Trump since the beginning, but you're honestly worse than he is. At least he's honest about how shitty of a human being he is. You pretend to have values and morals, and then you support policies that continue to reinforce economic and racial inequality under the surface. Okay, so this escalated very quickly. So I wrote back to him, yeah, I'm definitely worse than Trump. You got me there. He kept going. Yeah, your snide comment, it was a snide comment, won't overcome the million dead Iraqis, Charlie. Okay, so if you don't support the CDC eviction moratorium, we're back to the million dead, you want to kill Iraqis. Okay, you're a bad person and a worse intellectual. Neoconservatives like yourself delivered us Trump. So yes, you are worse. At least when we fight Trump, we know our enemy. You evil sons of bitches, and that probably includes you, supported invading a country and act like you still have an ounce of moral.
Can I just pause here? Because I get this a lot too. Glenn Greenwald also, every time he attacks me, he's like, you were with Bush in the Iraq War. And I'm like, I was 16 when the Iraq War started, okay? Like, I did not support the Iraq War. I never worked for George Bush. I mean, I guess I supported the Iraq War tacitly as like a high school kid who like thought it was cool and like, whoops, like that was a big mistake. But I mean, you know, I do. I have a lot of get you can get me for, but they do always come for the whack word, which Joe Biden fucking voted for, by the way.
No, that's okay.
You know, I was a teenager.
I think you're worse than Trump, too. So at least in this guy's okay. So yes, you are worse. At least when we fight Trump, we know our enemy, you evil sons of bitches, supported invading a country and act like you still have an ounce of moral high ground left. If I was you, I would work on shutting the fuck up and using my obscene amount of wealth. Okay, what? All right. To actually fucking help my fellow Americans. I'd also apologize for being a complete shit, but I have a soul, so I don't expect that from you. Okay, so this required a response, and I wrote back, thanks for your thoughts. I hope you understand why I'm blocking you. Please do not take it personally. It's just that your stuff is too stupid to keep reading. To which he said, laughing my ass off, cool Charlie, hope you enjoy hell.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's
so lovely. It's lovely. Just so people know that there are limits to disagreement, like any disagreement. Yeah. This is the interesting thing, is that there was once a time in my life when I made a real distinction saying, okay, you and I can disagree about X, Y, and Z, but it doesn't mean that you are a bad person. We just disagree on these policies. But if you notice how much of politics is that if you disagree with me on this policy, you are an evil, evil person. And I think this is kind of the new thing, right? It's just like, I am done with you. We're not going to talk about whether or not we want to have the CDC have the power to shut down the economy every time it thinks, no statute. The Supreme Court basically told the administration, you cannot do this. Joe Biden's acknowledged that most of the constitutional scholars that he's talked to think that it's illegal. But if you do not take this position, you are like the worst fucking human being on earth.
I do think, Charlie, the nice thing about I'm going to be positive here. The nice thing about the Bulwark community is that, like, I do get a lot of mail, and this is not a fish for male compliments, so I welcome compliments, just like anyone else. Mm-hmm. I do think that because we're able to have these longer, more in-depth conversations, and because people have, like, chosen to come and take the time to learn our points of view, and that we have lengthy exchanges with readers, and most of us, most of the time we reply and hear everybody's point of views, that, like, you learn that you get this sort of more, full and layered view of a human and about their attempts to try to tackle complex issues. And so I think that's why we get frankly less hate mail than at other places. And so what I've tried to do is, where somebody's like, Tim, you're a shit because of the Iraq war. Like, I just try to block that out. So I'm like, this person, I'm not going to let this affect me. This person does not actually not know anything about me. Though, we all have our weak moments, as it seems like you might have, Charlie. But it stings deeper when it's somebody who's like, I've been watching you and listening to you, and I've decided you're a shit.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that, send me into therapy.
Well, I'm in terms of the letters we get, as you know, I put out a newsletter every weekend, usually Sunday morning. I try to get it out Sunday morning, which is the reader feedback, and the vast majority
they're of great.
Is they are great, and they are really they're positive. But that's the interesting thing. Now, that's the thing that really strikes me, is how thoughtful our listeners and readers are, and how capable they are of nuance, and they take time to write really substantive responses, unlike the one that I just shared with you on this podcast. So if you are a Bulwark plus a subscriber, check your mailbox on Sunday, and you will see a different view. Okay, so we haven't
For a substantive response, by the way. I don't know anything about so one of the pay-fors, I'm just throwing this out there to readers, so we're talking about emails. One of the pay-fors of this infrastructure bill is we're making the crypto bros pay some taxes on their crypto. And just as a general principle, I think that's great. And so I tweeted that, and I had multiple while you were getting Iraq war tax yesterday, my inbox was like from all the crypto bros that are like, oh, you're an idiot, like blah blah blah, sending memes. And I'm waiting for someone to send me. I'm open to the fact that what they're doing is bad. I don't know anything about the substance of the bill and the infrastructure bill. Just as a general principle, I just think that the crypto bros should pay taxes like everybody else. And so if there is a substantive criticism, I'm open to that. We'll do it. We'll even run it.
We will run it. Okay, so we haven't talked about Andrew Cuomo. No point discussing whether he should resign. Of course, he should resign. He should be out. Do you think he survives this? And then of course, that depends on your definition of the word survives.
Yeah. I don't, because of the numbers in the legislature, it feels like they could impeach him. I think the big question is, could Cuomo play a game of chicken with the New York Senate and House? And you know, he has a lot of powers at his disposal to, you know, twist some arms and buy some people off, maybe people who might pay lip services to supporting impeachment, but not actually support it. And so, you know, the question is, could he play a game of chicken with the leadership of the New York State Legislature and get them to back down and survive? I just don't know enough about the current dynamics the mood in Albany, if you will, to know whether that's possible. It feels like it's possible, but so I'm not saying he's 100% out, but boy, the odds seem to be in his disfavor and extremely well deserved. I'm literally the only people defending him right now are like the Newsmax guy, you know, and.
Okay, so that was my next question is I who is defending him? Because there is the asymmetry, because you know, Trump could count on, you know, the usual, you know, amen corner, you know, to support him, and he had a, you know, media ecosystem that was going to support him and everything. I just don't see anyone coming to Andrew Cuomo's defense on CNN, MSNBC. It ranges from, you know, just, you know, pure outrage to thorough disgust, you know, and how fast to get rid of him. So who is and there are no Democrats that have come out and said, we stand with you. He's shedding people at a stunning, stunning rate. So who's the Newsmax guy that's defending him?
Greg Kelly. Greg Kelly's Twitter feed is insane. It's like, I hate... You know, I've done very good about culling my feed. You know, if I'm working on an article, I'll go into the crazy swamps, you know, and watch the stupid Bannon podcast or video stream or whatever I need to do to know to write an article. But just day to day for my mental health, I've tried to cull my Twitter feed of the crazy, and only a few have survived. And Greg Kelly's feed is just too fucking weird to get rid of.
But it's
insane.
What is the defense? Because every single day it looks like it's not just that he harassed these women, not just that the evidence is pretty strong, but now the reports about the way he tried to retaliate against them, you know, what they, I mean, this guy is, I mean, see, I don't want to call him a chode because he's a complete dick. I mean,
the defense basically is that this is like the first sex, this isn't true, but this is what I've seen, is that this is, you know, these are the off the record Cuomo allies being like, this is the first sex scandal in history that didn't involve any sex. You know, and it's not great. And Kelly is obviously, you know, in a traditional Trumpy stooge manner, is attacking the victims and, you know, saying they're making it up and all this stuff for fame and blah, blah, blah. There isn't like that much. There isn't a substantive defense. And you know, look, the Democrats ran Franken out on the rail on far less than this.
Way less.
You know, so this is a good thing. You know, the Franken thing, you know, regardless of what you think about the particulars, you know, holding folks accountable is a good thing. And I think that, you know, we did our alternate history on Georgia. You roll back the clock to 90. The 90s, right? I mean, had the Democrats been tougher on Clinton, like, would that
I said that last night. I actually said that on television yesterday that you look at the evolution of the Democratic Party. I think that they do recognize they paid a price for that. Looking the other way, you know, gathering around. So the rules have changed. I mean,
for Democrats,
we've talked about this. I mean, I think that you don't get Trump without Clinton, and that Trump really was able to leverage the indifference about Clinton to his benefit. And so I do think that there's been a transformation. And the contrast between the Republicans and the Democrats is pretty stark here. However, I think it would be incredibly naive to think that the Democrats doing the right thing with Andrew Cuomo will shame the Republicans in doing the right thing in the future, because I think we've kind of crossed those red lines, haven't we?
If anything, it's like that. It's like the polarization, right? I mean, the Republicans seem to get worse. I mean, they literally supported a man who like admitted to pedophilia in the Alabama Senate race. So no, I don't think. And Gates is still there, and so but that doesn't make it. That doesn't make it okay. And the Democrats need to figure out a way to use this to their political advantage. And I think that obviously that the gender gap has widened to the Democrats' benefit, and And so, you know, I think that there is, in addition to the ethical principle being correct, you know, there's political benefit to being seen as the responsible party.
One would think so, or at least at one point that would have been plausible. I kind of wonder whether or not that even applies any longer to our politics. So anyway, happy Friday and welcome back. I'm glad you're back. I hope you were able to salvage some of your Hot Joe summer still, Tim.
It was wonderful, and I'm happy to be back. And I'm sure, you know, we'll deal to. It won't be quite as much face licking as I was hoping for, I guess. But it still seems pretty darn good. Hard to complain.
I am just going to leave it right there at the face licking because we are not going to go beat past that at this point. Thank you all for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back on Monday, and we will do this all over again.